It's a pleasure today to welcome onto the show historian of ideas, best-selling author, and rational positivist, Johan Norberg. Today we're talking about his new book, Open, The Story of Human Progress. But before we get into it all, Johan, I do have to ask you, how are you today? Are you keeping well? And also, have you been happy with the response to your new release?
Well, thank you. Yes, I'm well, and I'm very happy. You know, it's a little bit worrying always to publish a new book, because it's like you're going to work every day for a year or so, but you never get any feedback or from listeners or colleagues or the boss, and then suddenly you get all of it at once. but so far it's very nice. I just got the review in The Economist to die for. They really love my book, so now I'm happy.
Yeah, I saw that Economist review as well, and you know, I've been, you know, reading your work since 2003. Globalization is good. You know, you had your book there and also the TV program that was actually shown in England on Channel 4. And I've kept up to date with your work since then. However, do you think that this new book, Open, The Story of Human Progress, is your most important work to date?
Yeah, I think so, because this is the one where I'm trying to, in a way, come up with a synthesis or a summary of my thoughts about human nature and human history, why we've created the kind of progress that we have today, and why it's also threatened. So there is also a bit of a warning there. And I think both part of it is extremely important, especially in this day and age.
And I think as well, you know, people reading your previous books and this one as well, at the start of the book, you explain that this one is both a prequel and a sequel to your 2016 book Progress. You know, that sounds very much like a Christopher Nolan film plot. But once you read the book, it does make sense. Would you say, to hammer home the importance of your message, do you have to read these books in tandem, in a certain order, or does it not really matter? Will both messages come through?
Well, that's a great comparison with the Nolan film. It's like, yes, this book is in a way inverted, and it goes back in a temporal pincer, going back to my previous argument and strengthening it in a way. I would say that for the average reader, if you don't buy the message that if there is a golden era, we live in it right now. If someone doubts that we've made incredible advances in terms of human lifespans, health, wealth, human opportunities, and so on, then I think you should read my book Progress first, because that's the one trying to convince you about that look, we can't take it for granted, because this is actually a historical anomaly. We've never had this kind of progress before. But if you buy that argument, then I think the Open is a nice place. If you bought that argument, or if you read Progress, then Open explains why we have that progress, the kind of institutions, the kind of openness that we need to make progress, and also why we can't take it for granted. It is sometimes in peril.
Reading this book, you do get the feeling that this is more than just an insight into openness. You know, you're a historian of ideas, but this is a warning that things could be closed off and we might be at a danger point. Was this the real inspiration behind writing? I mean, even in your acknowledgements, you say that this may save civilization.
Well, yeah, that's a bit of a inside joke, actually. But yes, I fear for our world. I fear for our open world and the progress that we have, because it's not automatic. It doesn't happen by itself. It's dependent on particular institutions giving us freedom to experiment and explore new knowledge. And that's something that is being challenged today. I think both from parts of the left and from the right, there is this sense, this longing for strong leaders and big governments telling us what to do and protecting us against everything that's strange that comes from somewhere else. And historically, we've seen that when we have that kind of reaction, it often shuts down progress. So it is a bit of a warning, and that's a reason why I wrote it.
And I think the fascinating thing about the narrative, you know, in the first few chapters, you actually challenge the hegemonic narrative of linear history, that, You know, it's progression, especially when it concerns the West. You know, you look at our history books and it's always kind of seen as the West has done this and then it's done this, and kind of brings it all the way back to the ancient Greeks, who are seen as like the forefathers. But actually, you know, when you look at it, it was actually the story of trade between humans, of ideas as well as goods, and it was humans actually finding these spaces of openness. But why do you think that this honest appraisal of history has been removed from what we're generally taught about?
Yes, this is very fascinating because I think that had an alien, a Martian, come down on planet Earth 1,000 years ago and tried to predict, so where are we? Will we see a Renaissance, an Enlightenment, an Industrial Revolution, and liberal democracy developing? He would surely have said that it cannot come from Europe, this backward continent. Obviously, it'll be from the Muslim Arab world or from China, from Song China, because they happen to be the most developed parts of the globe at that point in history. And that was because they were then more open than Europe and more open than other civilizations to influences, to exchange, to trade with others, so that they could make use of the ideas, the innovations, the skills, and the work of people in other parts of the world. And that creates progress historically. Now, we forget this, that it has happened before, that we've had these golden eras in other parts of the world, for a simple reason, I think. And that's because we always study history in reverse. Now we're back to a Christopher Nolan movie in a way. We start with where we are. And it so appeared that, yes, industrial civilization and liberal democracy started in Europe. And then we go back in history to try to find the first clues, the first steps on that journey. And it's easy to do that for because every civilization has had those steps. And obviously the first civilization that really made great advances in science and philosophy, the Greek civilization, is between the East and West. So any civilization that came later on would always count Greek as the natural starting point of it, and then try to see a logical sequence from there. But so did the Muslim world for a long period. So did China, as well, not really pointing to Greece, but their own first steps on that journey. So it's a difficult story, this sort of logical Western sequence of events. It's a difficult one because it's dependent also on just saying that 1,000 years of somewhat dark ages were just sort of a parenthesis, an abomination. So it doesn't follow through. It's not logical. The fact is that we've had many golden eras in different places, and it's always dependent on not a particular culture or a population, ethnicity, or religion. It's dependent on how open those civilizations were.
And would you say as well, you know, the reason maybe that it was buried is because of these natural tendencies in society to kind of justify certain belief systems? You know, you talk a little bit later in the book, which we will get on to, of, you know, conservatism versus progress kind of individuals. Is it these people trying to create narratives to justify themselves? And if they actually kind of enlightened us to these sort of Chinese, Islamic kind of revolutions in knowledge, that would be detriment to actually the West always being dominant.
Yes, absolutely. Every civilization has done this. Every ruler, in a way, wants to point to a glorious history and that which gives us a particular role in world history. And also, obviously, then, and it follows from this, that particular leader is the one that sort of is the true carrier of the torch, so to speak. And we've done that in Western civilization as well, to try to give some legitimacy to our particular place and role. The problem with doing that is that and again, every culture can do this. The problem is that when we do that, it's sort of plays on this tribalist instinct that we are the the carry us onwards of a particular destiny. We are the greatest. But that's not the case. It's dependent on what we do. And every golden era that we've had in every civilization, there is a golden era in almost all of them, was dependent on something else, being open to the idea that others have important ideas and innovations to contribute as well.
Diving more into the content here, and you quote Mary Wollstonecraft, the famous forward-thinking feminist thinker, and the last 200 years, as we've seen in your book Progress, and this as well, you know, open the story of human progress, life has improved for humans as a whole. But men have seen more benefits than women. Ethnic minorities and LGBTQ individuals are still marginalized and discriminated. You know, women do most of the majority of unpaid labor, and that's kind of attached to ideas of femininity. So why has this happened? How can openness help here without governmental or legal protections? Or is it a lack of openness and the folly of holding on to old ways that has actually let people down?
Yes, I think that we're living now with the legacy of a lack of openness, because all these groups have been discriminated against and for a very, very long time. And not just here and there coincidentally, but systematically and consistently. And that you always have a legacy after having done that. Now what we've seen, and this is something that I document in my book Progress, is that we have begun to open this up for the first time and given equal rights to women, to minorities in various ways. And it's a long-term progress. It takes a long time, but we are getting there. I just noticed a data point from the World Bank. They have a particular index of women's rights in business, legal rights, education, and so on. And women are still not there in high-income countries. It's around 95 out of 100, where 100 is the rights and opportunities of men. So there's still a struggle ahead. But compare that historically to where they were in 1970 at 55 out of 100. And that tells you something about the incredible speed of this progress in recent decades. Now, after having had this systematic discrimination for such a long time, it leaves a legacy. And the particular legacy here is that we think that women and minorities should be confined to a particular role, because everything that we've learned about them, their skills, their ability, and what they are comfortable with comes from a period in which they didn't have an opportunity to get the education, the career, the opportunities that white straight men had. And therefore, it'll take another couple of generations, I think, before we begin to see that those opportunities means that people then also prove themselves, that there wasn't anything inherent in their group and their belonging that made it impossible for them to reach the to make the same career as others. But then as that happens, then the natural sequence of events is that people begin to react more against discrimination and holding these groups back.
Would you say, though, as well, a lot of feminist thinkers, scientists alike, say that women need to be involved in more of these conversations, as with ethnic groups, LGBTQ. Is that going to happen naturally as society opens up, or should it be imposed as some kind of thinkers discuss, you know, enforced positive discrimination?
I think it happens naturally. It doesn't happen as quick as we would like it to happen. But I think that we should avoid any kind of positive discrimination as far as it's possible for two reasons. The first one is that with positive discrimination, we kind of turn our own ideals about equality on its head. Even though we do it for a good reason, it means that we put more importance on the group, on belonging, rather than on the individual and his or her rights. And that's always problematic, because then there's always bound to be someone who will suffer. And then what happens is often in cultures, in times and places where we've done that, is that we create other losers who don't just happen to be losers, but for a but because the system of rules, of laws, of regulations are suddenly turned against them. And that creates exactly the kind of hostile reactions against new groups, against their rights, against opening up societies further, creates backlashes, creates racism, creates misogyny in various ways. So in any way that we can have let this natural development have take its role, I think we should prefer that.
Now, kind of developing it a little bit further, you talked about the Darkening Age and the fact that the upward trend in logicism and imperial thinking was not a given, you know, and this is a story that you see throughout your book that, contrary to a lot of narratives, it's not a given that we always see progress and we need to fight for this. And this is why openness is so important now, that we're at a dangerous crossroads where we see post-truth and the sciences are under attack. Do you feel that there really is a big danger at the moment?
I think there is, because there's always that temptation to ignore the witness of your own eyes and just follow your tribe, especially in times of political divisions and when the temper runs high. There's always this temptation for our Stone Age brains to just follow our leader or our particular group wherever they lead us. And then they can come up with as many fake news and alternative facts as they like, because now it's not really a matter of empirical conclusions and objective facts that we can discuss and debate. Now it's more of a matter, so whose side are you on? And it's a way of showing our tribal allegiance. And I think that we're seeing that a lot in politics right now. And that has got to stop. I don't think it's sort of spreading around the world and to everybody. I think this is something that the most active activists and politicians are dealing with, those who still pay too much attention to politics in a way, whereas the great exhausted majority is just exhausted and think that there's something strange going on in the world of politics. That exhausted majority has to find its own voice, I think, because otherwise we've seen historically that things can become pretty nasty. If it's not a matter of debate back and forth, if it's not a matter of trying to find truths, but instead becomes a political war between different groups, that's bound for problems.
Is one of the dangers at the moment, though, that certain world leaders have shifted the Overton window so far in one direction that it will take a while to shift to get back to more openness kind of thinking?
Yes, in a way. And I think that's also because we've had this. There are two different things going on at once. One of them being that we have had a great backlash against openness, against globalization, trade, migration, international cooperation. And then suddenly that opens it up for fringes to take over politics in many places. And they are bound to do things that were not within what we used to think of as the Overton window. They are often people who haven't got the long background in politics. Strange things happen when the times are changing like that. So that's the first thing. The other thing that is going on is that politics has become a spectator sport in a way. Many have tuned out of this, and that has left room for radicals on both sides, people who are not used to this. That thing that you really need to show that you've got nerves of steel and that you can wait for a long time for results, because there are many different ideas and interests and groups involved. And to find compromises that people can live with, that takes a long time. And many of the radicals today, they don't have that time, so they just act. And then they act and talk in ways that we're not used to And you're right, that shifts what people think is possible and acceptable. And to put that genie back into the bottle, that's difficult.
Would you say, though, something about the discussion about protecting democracy is actually the system of democracy itself. So, you talk about fringes just then. Is there a certain way to do democracy that's best? You know, is it first past the post? Is it proportional representation? Is it parliament? Is it republic? Do you have a system in place that would protect openness in the best way possible?
I don't think we do, because I think we've seen these kinds of backlashes in many different places and with different electoral systems. And I, for one, don't think that our system of democracy is ever finished and that we've found the perfect solution. Perhaps there's a point in having various systems and experiment that we can learn from. But what I do think, generally, when it comes to not just protecting openness in itself, but also to protect people, means that we need some forms of checks and balances, making sure that we have divisions of power in various ways, so that it's not the case that we get just one majority, one election with one particular majority, and they can do whatever they like with everybody and with our political system. We need protections for the minority, and the smallest, most important minority of all is the individual. We need those protections. And that means that we need to have both political and, I think, legal constraints on what the majority can do. And no one really likes that when they're in the majority, obviously, but everybody depends on it whenever they're in the minority. And I think that now that we're seeing a kind of radical politics on both the left and the right, everybody has to ask themselves, so would you be happy with these kinds of powers in the hands of a Donald Trump or a Nicolas Maduro or a Viktor Orban? And if you're not, then I don't think you should leave that kind of power in anybody's hands, because now we know that these individuals get power in certain places. So I think that if we sit down and reason about this and talk about not just this particular period in time when you happen to be in the majority, if you think about your long-term interests, I think we can all agree that giving a more limited role to what governments are allowed to do against individuals should be in everybody's interests.
Would you say maybe that your philosophy could be described as almost a Kantian categorical imperative, but towards always openness then?
I think so. And I don't think that openness is a particular interest, the interest of a particular group or anything like that. The idea of openness is the idea of each individual. And their right to search for new ideas, explore new knowledge and experiment with things, whether the majority or whether the ruler likes or your neighbor likes it or not. That's the kind of value and institution that I think is in everybody's interest. And yeah, perhaps we can call it a categorical imperative, because it's I think, the most important thing that we all have to keep in mind constantly.
Now, before we get to the listeners' questions, and, you know, maybe you help shape their views, you discussed the point that our opponents help us understand the world better than we otherwise would. Now, during the research and writing of this book, or maybe some of your other books as well, did you find any seemingly immediately opposing views that later changed your mind and that you agreed with?
Yes, that's a very good question. And I'm not particularly open-minded if I don't have a great answer to it. I would say that, yes, in lots and lots of places, obviously, I changed my mind. I learned more. I continue to hopefully have a more correct view of the world. One thing that really surprised me, and I didn't know, was were stories about our tribal instincts, our groupishness, because one of the things that I write about is that how close this comes to us. We're used to thinking of coalitions, that we belong to a particular group and that we fear the other groups because they're, our Stone Age brains think that they're out to get us. And that's why it's so easy to rally us and to make us worried about everybody else. Something that I learned during the research in this book is how fluid this tribalism is, that there are no fixed categories like that. It constantly changes according to time and place and perspective and potential common enemies and so on. But also many of the great psychological experiments that were supposed to show how tribal we were, like the famous robber's cave experiment of school kids who came to blows after just being playing games with one another for a while. I learned that these were particular circumstances. There were actually an earlier experiment by the same researcher when he found to his disappointment that the kids didn't start a fight because they had, he made the mistake of allowing them to meet first before he divided them into separate groups. So I learned a lot about how fluid our tribalism is and that it can change rapidly and dramatically.
And I think that's a positive story as well for people that are worried about, you know, openness and it being under threat, because you give great examples of football teams or, you know, even with political spheres, the changes in allegiances really change quickly in certain circumstances, and it is not fixed on personal attributes, personal economic problems. You know, these transcend all these sorts of things. So I think that is truly fascinating. But I think what a lot of people will find fascinating is these community questions. And as always with Radio Verulam, we are here to help the community. We're here to help you. So let's move into what the people want to know. And you know what, Johan? A lot of people have messaged me about this. There's been a lot of love for your book, your previous works. However, I think one of the most pressing questions we received from listeners was, when will we see the return of Dead Wrong, or possibly a new series like it?
Oh, that's wonderful. And to hear these questions and Dead Wrong coming back constantly, it reminds me of something that a wise retired politician once said, that the best thing you can do is to quit, because then you'll get all the love and people will say, oh, why aren't you doing that again, whatever that was. Dead Wrong in that particular series where I try to bust particular myths about specifically economics and for people with a very short attention span, meaning all of us basically. So in just 90 seconds, I'd talk about the subject like that. That particular format is gone, at least for now. It's not that we're running out of myths, but we want to try something different. And that will happen I would say perhaps, hopefully, by the beginning of next year, we'll have something new that looks a little bit like it, but hopefully much better.
Ah, well, there you go. Another thing to look forward to in 2021. but Swash has sent in a message asking yourself about your particular views on Georgism, or more broadly, a shift from taxation of productivity to taxation of natural resources. He says, specifically as a transition to a free market economy, whilst at the same time satiating current demand for some sort of redistribution. What are your feelings on that one, Johan?
Well, that's a very interesting question because, you know, taxes, well, the best taxes are the lowest taxes generally, but yes, there are some things that have to be funded and especially and whatever you think, there's always bound to be a transition of some sort and then we need those resources. So how do we do that? Well, the problem with taxes is that it's always a kind of a penalty. It's always you force people to pay something when they do something. And what do we tax? What do we penalize right now? Well, we penalize work. and investment and risk taking and businesses, which is absurd because those are the very things that we'd like to encourage in a society, right? We force people to pay when they pollute because we don't like pollution. We force them to pay when they buy tobacco or liquor because we want them to do less of it. But we also do it when it comes to work and risk taking and starting a business. And that's hopeless. So I'm in favor of any kind of tax system that transfers more of taxes from penalizing good behavior like that to into something else. And then I think that this idea from Henry George of shifting taxation to natural resources, to land, specifically the increase in the value of land, is promising. It is interesting because that's not really something that you are responsible for, the increase in the general value of land somewhere. And it might even make you use land in a more productive way because you want the revenue in another way, not just from the land, but from what you do on that land. So I'm sympathetic to more of a Georgian system of taxation. That does not mean that I think it's politically possible, but those things change, obviously.
And I think Swash would find your idea interesting of the new taxation system. Towards the end of your book, you know, you talk what many leftists might even say is very progressive, something even more above and beyond universal basic income. Maybe just explain that quickly to Swash.
Yeah, I think that we do have a problem with our welfare state and our system of entitlements and welfare payments and so on. And that is that it always discourages people from doing the right thing, because anyone who goes from living on entitlements or welfare, they face a steep punishment. They lose their entitlements, they lose those resources, and at the same time they have to pay lots of taxes on their income. And this is, I think, one of the greatest problems that we are facing right now when it comes to work and to poverty, that we're creating welfare dependency. And so is there any way to remove this? Well, there have been discussions of creating this universal basic income so that people get a we pay it out no matter how much a wage increases, so it doesn't discourage work. But the problem is that it's incredibly expensive, and it's an expensive way of sending tax money to the middle class and to the millionaires as well. So is there any other way to go? Well, there is an alternative called the negative income tax. And this was originally proposed by Milton Friedman, actually, the Nobel laureate in economics, who said that below a particular minimum, a guaranteed minimum of income, the government just tops up your income with a particular share of your shortfall, and we can discuss percentages here. And if you make more than that, you start paying tax, but only then. So just like a universal basic income, it would remove many of these sort of, you know, bureaucratic administrative overheads and snooping on the poor, trying to find out how they use their incomes and sell their assets to get something. But unlike a universal basic income, it would not hand out money to the middle classes and the rich, so that it would be more targeted and therefore also much cheaper.
It's always fascinating to see different types of taxation systems. And I think one thing that a lot of people ask us about again, though, Johan, Michael has put a question to you. He said, Johan, what should be Britain's post-Brexit economic plan B? Should free trade be totally on the agenda?
Well, to me, it is obvious. I think it should be Open Britain, obviously, with my book title, Open the Story of Human Progress. It should be. But I think it should be for Britain's sake. Because free trade, openness to the rest of the world is—it's, you know—it sounds like it's so nice and cuddly and generous and altruistic. That's not what openness is about. Openness is about being able to use the get access to the ideas, the innovations, the goods and services and technologies of others as well. So it's a way of getting the things that you need to make your own economy as strong as possible, to make sure that you get the inputs in your industry as cheap as possible, and to have as broad a market as possible to the rest of the world. So I think free trade, complete unilateral free trade, should be on the agenda. And I think that's something that would also make other countries more open to Britain in the long term. I think Britain should definitely avoid this temptation to sort of think that now that we're free from Brussels, we should start to pick winners in industry. We should start to subsidize particular companies, businesses, sectors that we think is the future over here. Because it is always trying to pick winners is a guaranteed way of picking losers. Because even if we would know which industry is the future of Britain or Europe or Sweden, the chance that the particular government or minister that's in charge right now would pick that one, with all the interests, the special interests, the rent seekers out there, the lobbyists trying to make sure that these subsidies end up in their pockets, the chance that they would pick the right one is minuscule. This is a way of picking losers and to hurt yourself. Trying to have an open playing field domestically and being open to the rest of the world, that's how I think that Britain will prosper after Brexit.
Now, we've got one last community question here from Annie. And, you know, maybe in the style of Dead Wrong, I don't have the jingle to hand, but she has asked, what is the biggest myth about economics and capitalism that you see?
Oh, yeah, the biggest one. I think that the biggest myth out there is the idea that the economy is a zero-sum game. That if someone wins out, it means that someone else has to lose. This is a myth that has launched a thousand mistakes, because you can see it everywhere. That's why everybody's so hostile to the rich, to the 1%, because we think that they stole it from us. If another country prospers, we think that they somehow is cheating when it comes to the trade system. That's why we think that it's so dangerous with immigrants and workers from other countries, because we think they take our jobs. We think that new machines, new technologies, they ruin the old jobs without creating new ones. So this is the biggest myth, because it has launched so many different mistakes in various places. Because the reality is that the open free market is the opposite of a zero-sum game, because it creates new wealth, it creates new knowledge, new technology, so that we can create more wealth and more people can prosper at the same time. And free trade means that no deal ever happens without both parties thinking that they benefit from something from it. So it should be obvious, but it's really not, because it's so counterintuitive. Because we always think that there's a lump sum out there and it's all a battle of getting it from the others. And I think this is, again, why we need a historical perspective to understand why we are where we are. Because if you try to compress the last 300,000 years of Homo sapiens, then the 200 years in which almost all of this happened, rapid economic growth and technological innovation, those 200 years would just be 1 minute of those 24 hours. And that's an amazing minute. It created sort of all of our wealth. It reduced extreme poverty from 90% to 9% and so on. It's a great minute to be alive, but that is not where our instincts came from. It's not where our attitudes came from. They came from the previous 300,000 years, or if you go into prehistory, the millions of years before. And during that era, if someone got rich, it was probably because he stole everything from you, because you didn't have rapid growth, you didn't have innovation. So it made sense to be hostile and suspicious about everybody else. Now it doesn't. So we have to try to restrain our instincts instead and count to 10 before we ruin the market that creates all the wealth that we depend upon.
And I suppose, you know, to enlighten Annie a little bit, do you think that the etymology of this fallacy comes from Karl Marx, the conflict theory, and, you know, all that sort of ideology?
Yes, the because you know, Karl Marx sat there in the British Museum's library and wrote about how capitalism is a zero-sum game, and it if the rich would get richer, but the middle class will become proletarians, and the proletarians would starve because the surplus value all disappears to the rich. He didn't have it in him to understand how organizing work in a more productive fashion and introducing new know-how and technology would create more wealth. But while he was alive, the per capita income of the British worker doubled for the first time in world history. It doubled while he was sitting there in the Library of British Museum writing. So he really should have looked out the window once in a while and see what was going on.
Now, we're going to move it back on to the discussions of the book here, and I hope everybody, you know, who got their question answered are happy. And to everybody else who didn't, unfortunately, that's all we got time for, because there's a lot to talk about this book. There's a lot about to speak about in such little time. But I do want to give people a broader understanding of everything and why they should delve into the book, Johan. So in the book, you open out the reasons for radicalization of modern politics, and it's mainly through groupthink. But we have reached this level due to dangerous levels of psychological sophistication in terms of methods of communicating political messages. Do you think that, you know, Cambridge Analytica, that scandal in Britain, but also the way that Facebook and other social media platforms glean emotional information about individuals to tap into these tribalisms. Is this one of the biggest, you know, dangers to democracy? But it is also based on openness because it is the use of technology in the free market system. How do we combat this seemingly two kind of combative ideas of openness of the free market to exchange information, but also combating an attack on our open democracy?
Yeah, I think there's some role being played by this kind of sophisticated analysis of where people are at and how to convince them. But I think it is smaller than we often think. I think that Cambridge Analytica has probably been a little bit oversold, perhaps a little bit by Cambridge Analytica as well, and their consultancies who want to pitch their future services to other politicians. And this is partly because I just read the book Not Born Yesterday by Hugo Mercier, who looks into this and shows that we're not as easily deceived as we can think. And as I point out in my book as well, you know, living in bubbles like that, getting a particular message from your political tribe, that's something that that newspapers used to do for us. You know, every household used to have one newspaper and happened to be in perfect alignment with their own political views, and they never ever met someone who thought anything differently. So I don't think that those sort of particular bubbles or even that sophisticated analysis is the thing that really changes our politics in a radical way. I think it is the obvious, the opposite. The fact that we actually do meet people with opposite views constantly, all the time online nowadays. And that has a disturbing effect on us because we're not used to seeing people, again, our Stone Age brains. And I like our Stone Age brains. They got us this far. So I don't want to sound too bitter about it. But it's not really developed to understand social media and the millions of people who constantly communicate with one another. What happens then is that you suddenly see people who are not in your tribe, but in your face constantly. And even if you don't follow them, you tend to see your own group constantly retweeting them and telling you, look, here's another stupid person from the other side. Look at the outrageous thing that they just said. And it makes you think that the enemy is at the gates. The enemy is suddenly everywhere. It seems like they're coming at you constantly. And that, I think, they've broken through the perimeter, and that radicalizes you, because then you think you have to fight back in a way that you don't think if the enemy is far, far away and you never hear from them. So I think that, have you thought about the fact that you spend suddenly so much time being angry at a person that you didn't even know existed 5 minutes ago? At least that's my experience. Suddenly, oh, this French author said something outrageous. Who's he? I don't know. He's just in the feed, my social media feed. Or this particular young student in a city that I actually never heard of, who just said that everybody who believes what I believe is retarded. And that makes you angry, and it makes you want to fight back and to get the support and the safety of your own tribe. And that is something that I think we are going to have to learn to live with in a new way, to understand that that French author and that student in that city that you never heard of, they were always outrageous. It's just that you didn't have Twitter, you didn't have Facebook before. That's the only thing that's new. It's not that the world is falling apart.
That's going to be something that our primitive tribalist minds are going to have to adapt to in years to come. But one thing in the present, and I was considering this, because is there a limitation to openness when it comes to natural monopolies? Is this a situation where things should be state-run, or should other provisions be laid on by the market?
I think it's difficult to give a general response, because it depends so much on what you think of as a natural monopoly. And what I've found is that many of the things that we once thought were natural monopolies, because there is no way to have any kind of competition, weren't really natural monopolies, as when a little bit of innovation and technological change appeared in other places. You might have thought that the railroads were natural monopolies, but then we got cars, we've got air transportation, we've got electrical scooters, at least in Sweden. Everywhere, it's difficult to walk without tripping over one. So I think that you have to come up with a more sophisticated analysis, not just about, is this a monopoly in the meaning that there is no competition right now, and look at potential competition, so that if a private interest uses this particular power source or infrastructure, this kind of utility, if they abuse it in a way that they just increase prices and lower quality, is there potential competition so that someone else would enter the market in that case? And if so, it's not really a monopoly at all. They always face competition. It's just not that it's there right now for the moment. So I think you would have to look at the particular sector and be a little bit smart about it. And oftentimes, I think, at least the experience is that even if you could come up with a theoretical case that the government would run a natural monopoly or something close to it better, reality is not always the theoretical utopia that you find in the textbooks, because then you also have the various interests, and you have the particular lobbyists who make an appearance. And the problem then is that since it's now a government monopoly, you don't even have the potential competition from an outsider who could appear if they abuse that monopoly.
Now, kind of talking about debates here and freedom of speech, you talk about bubbles of protection. We see this as political correctness, cancel culture, offending one another, and it's kind of proliferated onto a lot of academic and university campuses. However, in an open world, is there a realistic limit to freedom of speech, or should all things be allowed?
There might be a limit to freedom of speech, but it is so far away that I find it difficult to even even see and conceptualize it. I think that the limit is really about threats. It's about when you go from being rude or strange or controversial into threatening others. Then it's a matter of the law rather than speech. But when it comes to ideas, obviously there's another kind of societal limit and limitation, and that's that we should show some respect to others and try to behave and not being obnoxious just for the sake of it. But that's more of the kind of limits that we mutually agree upon in society. What I do find right now in much of the cancel culture is that it's not about fear or hostility to people being rude and offensive. It's that others look at the world in a different way, and that's offensive to you because you don't agree with it. And I can understand why, because I notice that all the time, and people who come up with another reading of the data can come up with very offensive conclusions, I think. But to me, that means as long as it doesn't break my bones and pick my pockets, as the traditional free speech advocates puts it, the best way of defeating bad speech is better speech, and not by calling the police, because otherwise you can never find a true, good, decent limit, because much speech should be controversial. That's how we learn from others. I wrote this book about openness, and I rely on lots of data and papers from universities and other researchers and scholars, but they are often positive to openness. They like it. They like free speech or migration and trade and so on. And that's fine as long as they have opponents at the university who have another reading of the data, and they often have another reading of the data, since we all have a confirmation bias, because they have another set of values and ideas. They are less interested in openness. They might be hostile to trade, to migration, and so on. But they are important. I need them to improve my own arguments, and they are better at finding the holes in my data and in those university papers that I've read than someone who is sympathetic to them. And that's the whole point. Often we are making the best progress when ideas collide. That's when we get the bright spark of scientific and intellectual development. So that's, in a way, we don't cancel your enemies. Listen to your enemies. Don't agree with them, but listen to their points, because they are experts in the very one thing that you are worst at, and that's finding the holes in your own argument and in your own reading of the facts. And you need that to improve your own arguments.
We're going to have to end here because, unfortunately, we've run out of time, but it's been an absolute pleasure. But we've got one big question to kind of end on here, Johan. And, even with COVID, financial crisis is on the horizon. You have warned with the famous Milton Friedman quote that nothing is so permanent as a temporary government scheme, and maybe COVID might stop openness. But generally, in your works and in your most recent kind of academic pieces, you remain positive, even in the face of all this adversity. So to end, for listeners, why can they remain positive in the face of all these problems going on?
Well, I think my best case for optimism is that we have made so many terrible mistakes, and yet we have come this far in our world. That tells you something about our perseverance, our ability to improvise and come up with new solutions to new difficult problems that we are facing constantly. And, it's impossible to study history without being somewhat optimistic about humanity, because you've seen how many stupid things we've done. And yet, in just 150 years, we improved life expectancy from 30 years to more than 70 years around the world. We reduced poverty from 90% to 9%. A child born today has a greater chance of reaching his retirement age than kids in previous generations had of reaching their fifth birthday. That tells you something about what we're capable of. And, you know, we have big problems today, but we've had big problems in the past as well, even bigger. And we got this far. And that, to me, is a comforting thought.
So for everybody listening today, make sure to pick up your copy of Open, The Story of Human Progress. It's out now. I highly recommend this book. It's a fascinating read. And also, you know, you can't put a price on staying positive. So for everybody listening, thank you so much today for your time, Johan.
Thank you very much, Jason. That was a pleasure.